Oh, blue light came on.
So FYI.
Recording. I'm keeping an eye on the. Okay, you're good to go, Chair.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. I have my gavel. I'm convening this meeting of the House Interim Committee on Revenue. It's Wednesday, December 16th. We have a couple of really interesting items on our agenda. Before we do that, I'd like to take attendance. Legislative Revenue Office, could you please do that?
Hi, this is Corinne. I'm in the hearing room, and I will take attendance. Just one second. Get to the right screen. Okay, Chair Nathanson.
I'm here.
Vice Chair Representative Marsh.
Present by video, Marsh.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Present by video.
Representative Alyssa Kenny-Geyer.
Present by video.
Representative Akasha Lawrence Spence. Representative Mark Owens.
Good afternoon, present by video.
And Representative Greg Smith.
Good afternoon, Representative Greg Smith is present by telephone.
Thank you. The first item on our agenda is just simply an explanation from me to you and to anyone who's listening to our hearing today. It's about committee bills. In a typical year, at this meeting, a House committee would be adopting bills to be introduced by the committee. This would be the pre-session filing, voting, saying that the committee is now forwarding these. These may be filed under the committee's name. That isn't going to happen this year. And I have a brief statement to read to you. Some of you may have noticed the adoption of committee measures is not on the agenda. Policy committees, and by the way, this was written from the Speaker's office. It's not just House Revenue Committee. Policy committees are not authorized to vote remotely under current House rules. In order to avoid unnecessary in-person gatherings at the Capitol, House committees will not adopt measures this week for pre-session filing. If you have a measure that is not being pre-session filed that you would like to consider as a committee measure, the committee can adopt measures once in session. So that's the end of that statement. That said, you know that there is an advantage to pre-session filing. It's not required, but the advantage is the bill is first read when the session first opens up in 2021. So those bills get in the hopper sooner than bills that are introduced later. So that's an advantage in some ways. I had mentioned committee bills before. We talked about it briefly in an earlier meeting, and there were a number of ideas submitted by Legislative Revenue Office to Legislative Council to prepare for consideration as committee bills. Now, we can't consider any of those as committee bills, but there were somewhere 30, 40, maybe a little more than that, bills that were submitted and drafted by Legislative Council for consideration. I intend to proceed with a bunch of those, maybe as many as, more than a dozen, maybe two dozen. I'll have to count them later. By and large, these are the technical or standard operating procedure bills or things that you would normally see happening. So I wanted to give you a sense for the sort of things that are in that list that I believe it's very likely the committee would have adopted as committee bills. For example, the tax revisers bill, it is all technical language adjustments to statute. There's a standard operating procedure, reconnection to federal tax code. We do it each time the session rolls around. So the standard reconnection bill. There is there are a number of tax credit bills, tax credit for bovine manure, tax credit for employee training, exemption for port property, exemption for historic property, tax credit for child with disability, tax credit for rural medical providers, tax credit for working family dependent care. And you get the idea. A lot of these things that are either tax credits or property tax exemptions that were coming up because of sunsets, those are things that would have been forwarded to us. I will just take care of those, sign them all, unless someone talks to me and says, you really want the bill, I can just take care of it. And then we'll be able to pre-session file all of those. There are a couple of others. One was not in the standard operating procedure group. For example, the broadcaster apportionment bill that the Senate committee had passed in the previous session, and it was poised to go through the Senate and come to us. This was a compromise bill that there was general agreement that this is probably what should be done, since it was a compromise bill with support from various parties. That one was on its way. It just couldn't make it through the process because the session ended last time. So I'm going to go ahead and pre-session file that one because it was already in the works and I just want to get it going again. Similarly, Senate Bill 1531A, there were some income tax credit changes that were being considered. It was already in the works. I'll get it in the works again. So if you have any other questions, please contact me, but no committee bills, and I'm taking care of a bunch of the stuff that's either SOP or it was already kind of in the works. Any questions about that? Okay, thank you. Next is an administrative update on the corporate activity tax. Chris, would you please introduce this topic for us?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue. So we have from the Department of Revenue, Katie Lawley and Xanne Culver. They're going to walk through a kind of the administrative aspect of the first year of the CAT. And so give me a second and I will attempt to share the screen. Okay, so Katie, whenever you're ready, please identify yourselves too for the record.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Katie Lawley, the Business Division Administrator at the Department of Revenue. I'll be providing a brief overview of the project we've undertaken to implement the new corporate activity tax, otherwise referred to as CAT. I also have Xanne Culver here today. She'll be providing an overview of the policy development process for the CAT. Next slide, please. So the CAT was passed by the 2019 legislature in order to provide more funding for education in Oregon. Overall, you can see that the implementation of the project is on track to be completed on time and within budget. Because of the size of this program and the time frame for implementation, we began work as soon as possible in June of 2019 by beginning to build the team, produce project documentation, and determine the scope of the project. The major project activities are coming to an end in the near future, but the official end date is actually next July. This will allow time for the team to make any necessary changes once returns are filed next spring and to complete project closeout activities. The project breaks out into four different areas that we'll cover today: budget and staffing, communication and outreach, policy and systems, and IT system configuration. There are many activities in these areas that are already complete, and that's what we're going to review with you. Next slide, please. On the budget, The CAP project, like I said, is on budget. We received funding for our startup expenses in the 2019 session. And then we received additional other fund limitation for the remainder of the biennium that was approved during the second 2020 special session. Total funding approved for this biennium is $13.8 million, which includes startup expenditures as well as staffing to begin administration. Major activities that are funded include project staffing, IT configuration, printing and postage, and costs for communication and outreach, among others. And through October, we have spent approximately $4.8 million of the allocated budget. Next slide, please. Just an update on hiring. In addition to the initial team that began during 2019, we've continued to keep positions filled in order to complete the work that's necessary to implement the new program. Recent hiring activity includes three limited duration administrative specialists that will be handling the expected influx of phone calls and tax assistance from tax practitioners and taxpayers as they prepare their first returns next year. We're also recruiting for six permanent tax auditors that will begin their training in February next year. And we'll be recruiting an office specialist who will be able to assist with the management of correspondence and providing clerical support to the CAT team. And just the CAT team has felt the impacts of COVID-19, which much like the rest of the world, and they've been working remotely almost 100% since April of this year. They've continued to get the work done and resolve difficulties while working in this fully remote world. Next slide, please. So phase one of our IT configuration included the ability for taxpayers to register, manage their accounts online, and make estimated payments. This phase was completed successfully earlier this year using our DOR, Department of Revenue resources. Next slide. Phase two work is currently underway, and this includes continued configuration for returns, filing enforcement, audits, collections, and reporting. Phase two programming is complete, and we recently completed unit testing and system testing. The final stage of testing, which is called end-to-end testing, began on November 23rd, and I believe we'll be wrapping up this week. We are on track for phase two go live in January 2021, which will allow taxpayers to file their tax returns. Once the system is live, we move into a 6-month stabilization period during which we can address any needed changes. Other systems work that is underway or complete includes readying our front end system to capture paper filed returns and working with e-file vendors who wish to provide CAP forms as part of their software offerings. This will allow taxpayers to file their returns online, similar to how they do their income tax returns. So this completes the general project overview, and now I'll turn it over to Xan to review the policy development side of the project.
Next, thanks, Chris. For the record, Xan Culver with the Oregon Department of Revenue. To inform businesses about the new tax and requirements to register and make estimated payments, we sent letters and emails, issued press releases, and held in-person and virtual meetings. Letters were sent to more than 682,000 businesses and individuals who had reported business income on 2018 tax returns. And we sent those letters to inform them of the new program and requirements that they may be subject to. The most recent batch of informational letters were sent out in October and November to 33,000 businesses that had not yet registered for the tax but had reported that business income in prior years. We've issued 40 press releases and 58 email updates to our CAT mailing list with nearly 10,000 subscribers. We've also made use of two social media platforms, Twitter and LinkedIn. We held two outreach tours, the first in fall of 2019 and the second in March of 2020. As we had previously reported, there were about 8 sessions we were able to hold before the COVID-19 pandemic had cut the March tour short. Then following in October, we held two online meetings with a briefing on tax requirements, policies, and rules. Participants were able to ask questions and receive answers, and a full list of the questions and answers from the two online meetings is available on the CAT webpage. We engaged directly with various industry groups to discuss sector-specific concerns. We also sent emails to all registered CPAs and licensed tax consultants in partnership with their state licensing boards in January and September to provide up-to-date information and reminders about the CAT. Our CAT webpage is updated regularly and includes information about the tax, FAQs, a worksheet to estimate payments, and training materials. We have a dedicated call center and a help email box staffed by a team dedicated to answering those taxpayers' questions. We've received and responded to over 3,000 emails to the help email box, and since late February, we've received over 10,000 calls with an average wait time of just 14 seconds. So what's next in communications? We're creating a series of short videos on specific aspects of the CAT, including guidance on filing the CAT tax return, COVID-19 relief options, and other topics that have garnered interest from stakeholders. The videos will be posted to the department's website this month, possibly the end of this week. Public service announcements will begin airing on local Oregon television and radio stations this month as well. We are planning to send a letter to registered taxpayers in February to remind them about their filing and continued payment obligations, as well as include a list of resources for additional information. Next slide, please. So in the policy development, we have adopted 24 permanent rules so far. These rules are intended to provide guidance on a variety of topics, including sourcing, estimated payments, exclusions, and sector-specific instructions. One new rule is in process for adoption relating to the exclusion of damages received from litigation, and one rule amendment to reflect changes to penalty provisions that were enacted in House Bill 4202 during the 2020 first special session. We're also preparing for the first return filing in April. We've received letters of intent from five software vendors to provide e-filing options for the 2020 CAT return, and we continue to coordinate with those vendors as they program their systems. As of yesterday, the tax returns were posted to our website, so the returns and instructions along with other forms are available. Next slide, please. So here's where we are now. As of Monday, 19,393 taxpayers have registered for the CAT program with the department. That's 280 more than we had the previous week. As of November 30th, we've received just over 20,500 estimated payments, totaling nearly $662 million. The amount distributed to the Fund for Student Success was updated today with a total just under $627 million. So last week it was $442 million. Now with a recent distribution, it's $627 million. I'd like to remind you though that these dollars are reflective of estimated payments only. We won't know the true tax liability for the 2020 tax year until those returns are filed and reconciled to the estimated payments. And while returns are due April 15th, taxpayers may request a six-month extension to file, although that's not an extension of time to pay. And in addition, the number of registered taxpayers will likely never total the number of businesses subject to the CAT, because businesses must register for the program within 30 days of exceeding $750,000 of commercial activity, but only businesses with over $1 million of taxable commercial activity will have a tax liability and a filing requirement. Next slide, please. So as the project nears completion and we, go ahead.
Sorry, and I apologize, Madam Chair. Would you like me to hold my question till later, or is it okay if I ask now?
No, that's fine. Let's keep it, you're on the point that's being made. Let's clear it up.
Perfect. Thank you. Can you talk to us very quickly? How is PPP dollars, Paycheck Protection Program dollars, going to be considered? Will that be commercial activity or non-commercial activity?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Smith, we do have an FAQ on our website related to that. The PPP dollars are not considered commercial activity. However, expenses used to, or expenses that PPP is paying for, if those are considered commercial activity, they are deductible or subtractable.
Just a quick comment, Madam Chair. So I would hope we could really make that clear to our smallest business owners who are going to be right at that threshold. As you folks know, PPP dollars are considered taxable by the IRS. And so I could just see where confusion is going to creep up. And so I would hope, as you folks continue your great work, we make sure we're educating folks on that issue. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Certainly. Go ahead.
Thank you. Okay, so as we are finalizing the implementation and roll more into complete administration, we do remain committed to ensuring transparency in the implementation process by including our external partners in project updates. Just this morning, we did this a similar presentation to the Oregon Business and Industry Group. We also remain committed to administering the CAT equitably, effectively, and efficiently by creating fair rules and ensuring that our staff are properly trained. We're committed to engaging closely with stakeholders from across business and industry in the development of administrative rules and other guidance. We're also committed to providing taxpayers with all the tools and information they need to comply with the new tax. Next slide. So that concludes our update for you today. As mentioned previously, we do have a help email and a dedicated phone number for questions that's listed here on this slide. Our contact information for Katie and myself is also listed if you have any questions, as well as a link to our website and our Twitter and LinkedIn accounts. And we're open for questions if you have any.
Great. The first question is from Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation. I don't know who to address this to, but I was just looking back at the revenue impact statement for House Bill 3427, which started this all off. And for the 2019 through 21 biennium, it says roughly about $1.6 billion in revenue. So you gave us an estimate, or you gave us an update today of where we're at today. What's that look like going forward when we end out the 21 biennium? Are we going to be at $1.6 billion, or are we going to be off by 25%, or where do you expect us to land on that?
I think I should probably handle that one, Rep. Reschke. This is Chris Allenack. So in the latest forecast, OEA is now providing updates to that revenue, and I believe their last forecast, the November forecast, had that number at about $1.2 billion is the latest estimate for the biennium. Keeping in mind that the numbers that DOR just presented were for the first tax year. And just
right. I understand it's the, yeah, right, exactly. So I know we've got another 6.5 months to run on it. So I'm just kind of trying to figure out where we're going to land. And you gave me that answer with 1.2. Okay, thank you.
I have a question about communication. And it occurs to me, in particular, because of Representative Smith's question, when you prepare an FAQ so that people, we would hope, can sometimes find an answer to their question without having to call or email, usually it should be reserved for a more particular situation related to that individual taxpayer. But on the FAQs that you write, do you have a stakeholder group that you run those by before you post them, or are they reviewed entirely by internal agency staff? The reason I'm asking is sometimes, not just your agency, but any agency, I'll read an FAQ and I can understand it. Usually, not always, I can usually understand it pretty well. It makes sense. But I understand that's because I'm familiar with a lot of inside baseball lingo, you know, and the way regular folks out here, the constituents that we represent, the way they read something might be different. So I'm just wondering what process you use to write and review an FAQ to make sure it's in the most user-friendly language possible, maybe even sometimes with graphics or something.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Members of the committee, I can address that. To answer your question, we don't have a current stakeholder board that we run those through. Our process is, like you said, is more internal. We do have our communications folks within Department of Revenue review those for readability and the language standards that are that are applicable. We also do send out, we have, I think Xan mentioned this, we have a Gov delivery system where we send out updates to people who have signed up to receive the updates. And we do send those out when we make updates to the website. So hopefully if people are, you know, are confused or whatnot, then they will respond to that and let us know. But we can definitely look into other processes to ensure that they're as clear as possible.
Thank you. I would appreciate that. That would be great. Other questions, Representative Lawrence Spence.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and for presentation. I was really impressed by the ways in which you. Are you having difficulty hearing? I can't see you leaning in. Hold on. Okay. Got a little better. Essentially, you guys had a really extensive presentation talking about ways in which you not only
excuse me, Representative Lawrence Spence, I'm still having a lot of trouble making out everything you're saying.
Somebody else is not on mute, so some of that noise is not even from me.
It wasn't noise, it's the volume at your end, perhaps?
Is this better?
A little, yeah.
A little? And I'm gonna lean into the computer and turn off my camera, maybe that'll help. So part of your presentation, you talked about the expansive outreach that you guys have done, not only looking at the businesses that would have registered or have a certain amount, a threshold of revenue, as well as the CPAs that would typically be serving them. I would like to know what sort of interagency coordination did that take in order to get those lists and to reach out to all of those varied stakeholders who would be able to file for this corporate activity tax.
Thank you, Representative, Chair, members of the committee. So we did work with some other partner agencies, the tax licensing boards, for instance. We also reached out to chambers of commerce and other other interested agencies and organizations throughout Oregon in order to ensure that we were really covering all the different industries and all the different groups, and specifically, like others have mentioned, trying to target some of the smaller businesses that may not have heard about this tax or they're unfamiliar with their requirements related to it.
Madam Chair, if I may, just a clarifying question. I really wanted to know what agencies, governmental agencies, helped you to procure those lists. So CPAs are registered with who exactly, and how did you get that data? Because that's essentially data, right? And what enabled you to be able to gain access to those lists? What kind of coordination did that take?
Okay, thank you for the clarification. Right, the State Board of Accountancy is the agency that covers CPAs in particular, and our communications staff really just reached out to them. I believe that information is public information, and we were just able to coordinate, and I don't believe it took very much effort on our part, and we felt it was very important. We already have good good relationships with a lot of those folks that we work with on a regular basis. So I don't know that they were surprised to hear from us, but I think that was the process that we used. Does that answer the question?
It does. Thank you so much.
Are there any other questions? I don't see any other hands up in the request list. I'll wait about 15 seconds. And if you're having trouble figuring out raising your hand, just say something out loud. Okay, thank you very much for the presentation. Still not seeing any other questions. We really appreciate it. We are ready to move to the next agenda item. When I discussed this interest of mine with Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office, I want to tell you what was on my mind. For the state to deal with a global pandemic, and then on top of it in September, the catastrophic wildfires that affected multiple locations around the state, this had an enormous impact on the social and economic well-being of the entire state. We knew that it was a situation where it needed to be all hands on deck, so to speak. Every agency would be involved in some way. Every legislative office would be involved in some way. And indeed, we were. So even though it didn't seem like a natural at first, not LRO, but a couple other people who I mentioned this to thought, well, what does Revenue Committee have to do with dealing with the pandemic? I thought, well, there's a lot that we might consider where there's an intersection between the well-being of people and businesses and the state's economy. And what is it that our committee could or should be doing, or any state agencies that we typically work with in our purview? How are we involved in responding to the pandemic and also the wildfires? So we developed this short list of topic areas for response. What has been done by state agencies to respond? What were they able to do within just standard practice in their agency, or through adopting administrative rules very quickly, let's say? What could agencies do right away to help respond? What is it that we could be doing now? And that's where Representative Marsh is going to come in to the conversation. And then looking forward, what else could we or the agencies that we work with be looking at as potential ways to be included in responding to the needs of individuals and businesses in Oregon, and to help the underpinnings of the state's economy and revenue? So with that, that's what was on my mind. How can we be involved, and how can we help? Chris Allenack, will you please introduce the item for us?
Sure, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So the first item is the Department of Revenue. Katie Lawley is going to highlight and describe some of the administrative actions that the department took this past year. So Katie?
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Katie Lawley from the Department of Revenue. I'm here today to provide a brief overview of the administrative relief we provided in response to the COVID-19 pandemic and the wildfires. The department's efforts were primarily in the form of delayed tax filing and payments, or delayed collections activities. On all lists, you'll find a summary of the information that I'll cover, as well as a link to our website with more detailed information. Chris is sharing it now. Thank you. So we closely followed the notice that was issued by the Secretary of the Treasury to provide as much administrative relief as we could for those impacted by the pandemic or the state of emergency. In March and April, we issued two director's orders that provided an automatic extension of the return and payment deadlines for tax year 2019 for personal income, corporate income and excise, estate transfer, and transit self-employment taxes. For all tax programs, we extended the deadline for taxpayers to file administrative appeals, refund claims, and interest accruals. The senior and disabled property tax deferral application deadline was also extended. For the corporate activity tax, there were no returns due during 2020, so we focused our relief on estimated payments by increasing the safe harbor, which is up to $10,000, under which payments are not required. This enabled smaller taxpayers to not have to make payments during 2020. Taxpayers will also not be penalized if their inability to pay is due to COVID-19. This week, the governor announced additional administrative relief that we'll be implementing. This applies to small businesses and will be in the form of penalty and interest waivers for those with continued impact from the COVID-19 restrictions. We have issued two director's orders extending the payment deadline for the amusement device tax that is paid by Oregon Lottery video retailers, one in June and again just this month, due to reduction in player access to the video lottery games. Overall, some of the collections relief that we've provided to taxpayers, again, this is all related to their inability to pay and due to COVID and the wildfire. We've extended the maximum length of payment arrangements from 18 months up to a maximum of 36 months. We worked with taxpayers who were currently on a payment plan to enable them to skip a payment if they were having a financial hardship. And we also eased back on garnishment activity, including being careful not to garnish the Federal CARES Act rebates or returning that money if it was inadvertently garnished. Finally, relief for taxpayers who reside or have business located in one of the eight counties that was most impacted by the wildfire emergency included qualifying for penalty and interest waivers for late filed returns and payments. And we also offered free replacement of state tax documents if they needed them. This concludes my brief overview of the department provided administrative relief. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Representative Lawrence Spence.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just quick question for you. What was the communication effort around this to those stakeholders who would need to apply for forgiveness or abatement or what have you? What was your communication strategy on this effort?
Thank you, Chair and Representative Lawrence Spence. Our communications for these administrative options were, we issued press releases, news releases that went out statewide. We also updated our website and made it very prominent on our website, the link to get to the tax relief options. And we've also provided a list of frequently asked questions that go into a bit more detail or more specific situations for taxpayers.
Madam Chair, if you will, a follow-up?
Sure.
So this goes back to, I guess, the first question that I asked. When we look at communications, when we look at outreach or even sharing of listservs between agencies, and we look at the ways in which we are trying to get people, the efforts that we're taking to get people to pay the tax versus the communications efforts that we use when we're trying to provide solutions for people who can't, potentially cannot, are very different. And so, you know, thinking about the ways in which we effectively reach people and help them in this really unprecedented time of need, I would expect our communication strategy to be equivalent instead of simply just posting it on the website and creating a press release whereby a lot of people would not see it, right? So trying to have more equivalent communications when it's, you know, an effort to get someone to pay, as well as when it's an effort to help them in again, these uncharted times.
Thank you, Representative Lawrence Spence. I'm gonna follow up with a small detail, but might illustrate kind of outreach I am sometimes curious about. We know that Red Cross played a significant key role in organizing the outreach to those people affected by wildfire. Did Department of Revenue work specifically with either Red Cross or the 211 group?
Rep. Nathanson, I don't know for sure if we did. I do know that there is a link to our relief website included on the statewide, the full state government wildfire relief page. And so I don't know who exactly coordinated that, but I do know that we're also a part of that. I don't know which groups we worked with specifically.
That's fine, thank you. I think the point I'd like to add is consistent, very likely consistent with Representative Lawrence Spence. A lot of people wouldn't think to consult a website. Like, they don't wake up in the morning saying, I wonder what Department of Revenue has on its website today. Or they don't even know how to find a government agency website. It's just not an intuitive thing. But we do know that people ask for help. They call a food bank, or Red Cross finds them, or they call 211 when they need help or need a connection. And in addition to all of the efforts you are making to be thorough, in a way, it's inward focused. It's about the agencies, what kind of information the agencies provide. I think it would be very useful also, not just for Department of Revenue, but any state agency, to think about how can we get our information to the people who are actually in contact all the time with the people who are asking questions, and push it out a little closer to where people, the places they are visiting or the people they are calling. It's just a thought for how you might expand that kind of outreach. Representative Reske, you have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess it's more of a comment, but I just see the communication question fascinating, because in my mind, I think you're trying to communicate to two groups of people. One is CPAs, those that either prepare taxes for small businesses or those who work inside large corporations. And when you communicate with them, you can use Department of Revenue shorthand because they're familiar with this kind of stuff. But it's the small business owner who might be the salesperson and the accountant and the inventory guy and that isn't going to necessarily understand that shorthand or know where to go, or this isn't their full-time job because they got seven other jobs they're taking care of. And I'm wondering if there's some sort of bifurcated or some sort of delineated communication strategy that could be looked at as far as reaching small businesses versus larger corporations that are going to have accountants, or CPA firms that have accountants, that this is all they do.
Like the State Chamber of Commerce, for example.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. You know, again, I'm not aware of all the individual places that we coordinated with to get the word out. But I do know, just in general, we do coordinate with the small business development committees that are throughout Oregon in the different regions. Like I said, I don't know that we did that in this case, but we do work with them. And I understand what you're saying, right? I mean, people who are represented by a tax professional have, you know, they get a little different communication from us. And we do, I think, need to find other ways to communicate. Small businesses, I think we do a pretty good job, but I mean, there's always room for improvement. But I think it's the everyday taxpayer that, you know, I don't know that anyone wants us to send letters to everybody. And so, it's something we need to think about and plan for. And I appreciate the suggestion.
Thank you, Representative Reske and Lawrence Spence, for adding to this topic. I don't see any other raised hands. Let's move to the next item in this group. Chris?
The next item is a legislative concept that Representative Marsh has been spearheading. So I think she's going to talk about this. This has to do with property taxes and the wildfires. And at the time when the wildfires hit, the timing was unfortunate. Property tax bills went out shortly thereafter to folks who were dramatically affected by those wildfires, and many lost their homes. So there is an LC that Rep. Marsh has been putting together, and in OLIS there is the LC 2547, and there is also a discussion draft, kind of a policy document that describes the intent of the policy as well as a couple of examples. But I believe Rep. Marsh is going to walk the committee through the details of the goal and the intent of the policy.
Great, thank you. I hope that we can allow about 20 or 25 minutes for this item, and that should leave us at least 25 minutes for the last one. Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, and thank you, Chris, for that introduction. As Chris noted, and as we all know, on the weekend of Labor Day and shortly thereafter, the state lost 4,000 homes in wildfires in various areas across Oregon. 2,500 of those homes were in my own district. 2 months later, people began receiving their property tax bills, which had not yet been adjusted for the kind of experience that they just had. And as you can imagine, there was a lot of discussion within my own community about the calculation of those property tax bills and what people were actually obligated to pay. At the same time, I got wind through various communications that the State Association of County Assessors had identified corrections that they believe needed to be made in our, what we would all agree is pretty convoluted property tax law, in order to ensure fairness in a situation like this, and in order to simply streamline the process of prorating people's property tax bills after a disaster. So I reached out to the assessors, pulled together a work group that met probably a half a dozen times over in the subsequent weeks. The work group has included representatives from League of Cities, from the Association of Counties, from the home builders, clearly from the assessors and the tax collectors who are experts in all of this. We also had Oregon Law Center, the Department of Revenue, clearly our own legislative revenue staff, and Senators Findley and Representative Gomberg. So we've had a good and robust conversation, and I think broad agreement in what we're trying to achieve with LC 2547. As Chris noted, the LC is posted. I'd also refer you to this document that was put together by the assessors, who are absolutely the in-the-weeds people on this subject. I'm going to walk you very briefly through a summary of what we are trying to achieve with the LC, knowing that Jamie McGovern from our own staff and Joe Davidson from the assessors are standing by for those complicated questions that I can't answer for you. So in brief, what LC 2547 aims to do is three things. First, we want to establish equity in the way proration is conducted after a home is damaged or destroyed by wildfire or some other kind of disaster. Secondly, there was a need to rectify the way damaged properties specifically are dealt with. And third, we wanted to provide a path so that in cases similar to the wildfire that we just experienced, where you have had an emergency or a conflagration declaration in place, that tax collectors could expedite the proration of property tax bills without waiting for individual property owners to come forth and request it. So to go through those briefly, the first objective is equity. Under the current system, immediately after a disaster, assuming that there's been a complete destruction of the home, as there certainly was across my community in the recent wildfires, the real market value is reduced to the land value. So the structure has been destroyed, structure is removed from the property tax bill. Property tax bill is now simply reflective of the land value. But the problem there is that if that land value is at or above the property's maximum assessed value, then there is no reduction in the actual property tax bill. And I think I would refer you to the example that's offered by the assessors for property number one in the document, again, that's posted for this discussion. In this case, the real market value of the property was $150,000. The house was $50,000. The land was $100,000. House is wiped out. Property reverts to the maximum assessed value, but that maximum assessed value is above the current assessed value. So, in this case, a homeowner could have the home wiped out 2 months into a property tax season, as it was in the case of the Alameda fires or the fires across the state on Labor Day, and actually see no reduction whatsoever for the remaining balance of the year in the property tax. What we are proposing to do instead is to basically align the balance of the year after a disaster and the way the proration of that tax is calculated with the way it will be calculated in subsequent years, which is a process of basically determining the proportional value loss. So in the case of example number one, the proportional loss is 33%, so there would be a 33% reduction in the taxes for the remaining months of the year that comprise the rest of the property tax year. So person in number one would be billed for the full property tax value for the months preceding the month of the disaster. For the month of the disaster and all of the months remaining in the property tax year, they would see a reduction of 33% in the property tax that is owed in that case. So a proportional reduction in property tax is the aim of our first objective, which is to achieve equity in the calculation of the proration. Under this proposal, every household will see, will do a little bit better. No one will do worse. This is a way to simply ensure that people who have already undergone tremendous damage, who are left with very little, see some appropriate, equitable reduction in their property taxes. The second objective here is to simply address some of the gaps that existed when a house is not destroyed, but it is damaged. Under the current system, those individuals who have a house that is damaged have to pay their full property tax. They get a refund at the end of the property tax year. This will align the damaged homes in the same way that we deal with destroyed homes, which is that the property tax proration takes place immediately upon the event of the damage. And then the third objective that we're looking for here is to simply expedite the process of getting these adjustments made on the property tax rolls. And so we know that in many cases when there's been widespread destruction, when there's been a conflagration or an emergency, the tax collector is quite aware of where that destruction has taken place. So the bill simply gives the tax collector the ability to go ahead and make those adjustments on the property tax rolls so that the proration is already in place. The legal responsibility for requesting those adjustments will remain with the homeowner, because we know that there could be cases in which a tax collector is unable to identify where damage or destruction has taken place. But for many of the impacted properties, the tax collector and assessors will be able to go ahead and make the adjustment so that we can expedite this process and provide the kind of relief that property tax owners who have been in one of these awful situations have endured. So that's the LC. Our original hope was that we would be able to get this approved in a special session so that it could take place immediately and impact the property tax collections that are undergoing right now in areas of the state that have suffered from the wildfires. It's now clear that that's not going to happen. So this is an LC that we propose to bring forward in the long session. I think the only question that will still need to be discussed is whether or not, frankly, that will be too late to apply it to the current property tax year. We know that by the time we get this under discussion in the long session, that property taxes will have been collected. They will have been prorated under the existing system. That's not as good for homeowners. That's why we're doing the legislation. But to ask for all those calculations to be made again and additional refunds to be issued may be more too much to ask. So we need to have we will need to have a discussion with the assessors and tax collectors over that particular piece of the legislation. But other than that, I think the LC will be ready to bring forward in the long session. So that was my layperson's explanation of the property tax minutia that is involved in proration after a disaster. I will be happy to try to answer questions. I will also be happy to call on the team of professionals who are ready to answer questions that I can't.
I'll wait just a bit to see if there are any hands raised or listen for anyone asking. Yes, Representative Lawrence Spence.
I'll ask it, Representative Marsh. Thank you, Jenny, Representative Marsh. Thank you so much for your diligence and your work on this. My question is going to be a little strange, and that is this enough? Is this enough help for those who have lost their homes completely and are having to start from scratch? I know that, of course, they might get insurance payments and things like that, but is this enough help? Is this a compromise, or was this, you know, our best case scenario?
I'm sorry, I don't think.
Was it just me, or was it everybody who experienced some garbled audio?
I think I understood the question. This is Jamie, but you could also have Representative Lawrence Spence repeat the question.
I think the question is about, is this enough help? Was this a compromise? Is this the best we could do? I hope that got the gist of it. Jamie, is that what you understand?
Yes. The question?
Okay.
Yes, that's accurate.
Representative Marsh, what do you think?
You know, I think, Chair Nathanson, thank you, Lawrence, Representative Lawrence Sprints, for the question. You know, I think we have heard proposals to simply suspend property tax for everybody who was involved in the Alameda wildfire. I heard that proposal come forward, I think, from Marion County very early on. There are significant public policy questions involved in that. The property tax, we know, is integral to local government and contributes to our school system. It's supporting the fire districts, you know, that provided vital services during the fires. So simply suspending that property tax, I think, would require the state or somebody else to step up and backfill it. I think what we've gotten to here in terms of the property tax system as it currently exists is as equitable as we can imagine, given the constraints of the system that's currently in place. You know, equity is built in several different places. For example, we have in the past counted the month of the disaster, billed the property tax owner for the full complement of property taxes for the month of the disaster. So your house burns down and you still got to pay all the property taxes for that month. We are in the LC moving that back a month. So the month of the disaster is now counted as part of the month's of the balance of the year that are prorated appropriately. So we're doing our best to give those property owners a break. And I think this is particularly true on the damage front. Damage, people who have their homes damaged, which, you know, certainly can make them unlivable for a long period of time, have gotten no relief until the end of the year when they've had the ability to get a rebate of the property taxes that they paid. Under the new system, they'll be treated in the same way as completely destroyed situations. So their full property tax will only include the months prior to the occurrence of the damage, and then their property taxes will be appropriately prorated for the balance of the year. So I'm happy where we landed, given how convoluted our property tax system is to begin with.
Representative Owens.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Thanks, Rep. Marsh, for working on this. That was kind of the continuation of my conversation. First of all, thank you for putting the work group together, and I was glad to see that Association Morgan Counties was included. That, as you referred, that county's number one income is through property tax, but counties normally receive about 17% of that property tax. The rest go to special districts that perform the services that are needed in the counties, fire, search, and rescue. So to summarize my question, are any of those special districts going to be tried to be held harmless through this reduction? And has Association of Oregon Counties weighed in on this through the legislative committee to support it?
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, Rep. Owens. So another very interesting vagary of our property tax system is that within the year of the disaster, the property tax impact in a given county is spread across all taxing entities. So for example, in my district, the cities of Talent, Phoenix, and Fire District 5 are going to have significant property tax loss, but they are not going to see the impact of that loss until July of 2021. So the year that we're talking about here, which is the balance of the year, the disaster, the loss will be attributed across all property tax entities within the county. So you are spreading the pain as best you can across the county. And yes, the proposal, because it does benefit property owners, does mean that there'll be additional property tax loss to the entities, but only in that initial year, because in subsequent years, the kind of proration, that proportional proration, is actually the way that we do it anyway. So what we're doing with this proposal is to align the year of damage with the same property tax calculations that we have in subsequent years. Now, in subsequent years, there's no question that the taxing agencies where damage has taken place are going to be hit hard, but that's a whole nother question. We're not making it worse for them in subsequent years. Does that make sense?
It does. Being a former county commissioner, I understand part of that. The second part of my question, if I may, Chair Nathanson.
Yes.
As AOC, I would recommend, Rep. Marsh, that we get Association of Oregon County's Legislative Committee to weigh in on this and put support behind this, because they will be the ones most directly affected because of the tax income change. So,
Rep. Owens, I think that's a great suggestion. And we did, as I noted, we did have AOC and LOC involved in the discussions, and I think they all might certainly will have more discussions with them more broadly. But my impression is that we all see the basic fairness issue that's at play here.
Thank you.
Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Marsh, for bringing this forward. I can't imagine the loss of losing a home like that. It's just, it's unfathomable, and 2,500 in your district, that's tough. So I wanna say that first and foremost. I guess my question is, there's a loss to the county either way this is calculated, either the way we do it today or the way that you're proposing doing it. I'm just wondering if there's a difference or if it's neutral and you're just, as you said, spreading the pain across a greater number of people, lessening it so it's spread across more thin as opposed to it hitting certain people really hard. I'm just wondering, at the county level, are they going to see a greater loss in revenue because of LC 2547, or are they going to see more of a loss, or is it revenue neutral?
It is not revenue neutral. The benefit will accrue to property owners who have damaged or destroyed property. Because the calculation, which again is consistent with calculation that will take place in the initial, the next set of property tax years after the year of damage, we're aligning the calculation with the subsequent years. But for the year of damage, there will be a benefit to property owners that will result in a reduction in property tax revenues for taxing districts across the state. Again, the advantage that we have is that in that year of damage, the reduction in property tax is absorbed by all taxing agencies in the county. So in the case of Jackson County, you know, the cities of Medford and Gold Hill and all the special districts and everybody else is going to absorb a little bit of that hit. The cities that were most directly impacted and that have the most to lose won't feel that the volume of that hit until July 1st of 2021. So we have the advantage of spreading the lost revenue much more broadly across many other taxing entities in the year that's affected.
Thank you.
Chris, did I explain that properly?
You're on mute, Chair Nathanson.
Thank you. And I don't see any other raised hands. Any other calls for questions? Thank you, Representative Marsh, for presenting this for us today.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Chris, let's move to the final item.
Okay, the third item we had with us Mark McMullen from the Office of Economic Analysis and Joe Courtright, who is the chair of the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors. And to round out this discussion, the idea was to get some input from the council on potential actions the legislature may consider next session, some thoughts to keep in mind, some principles, some guiding, some guide rails or guidelines for the upcoming session as the legislature is crafting policy next year. So with that, I hand it over to Mark.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mark McMullen. I serve as the Oregon State Economist. So I'm just going to give a quick little intro about the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors and then go ahead and pass it off to our chair to start the conversation. So the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors was created 40 years ago by executive order from Governor Vicatia at the time, and the Governor's Council was designed at the time to really support our office and our prime directive of the economic and revenue forecast that this group knows so well. And the concept was to give policymakers more confidence in our work product and the objectivity of our estimates. And so to that end, the governor really appoints a wide range of voices to the group across different industries and across different political ideologies in order to try to give us the broadest perspective as possible. And so one implication of this is that in terms of, you know, specific guidance on tax policy, you know, there are a lot of voices, and it's very rare that the group's going to come up with a real strong consensus about policy options, given that it is a broad range of voices. But nevertheless, they have a lot of valuable input on tax policy, particularly in the challenging situation and unique environment that we're in right now. And so there's really no one better to speak for the council than Dr. Joe Courtright, who's been our chair for over a decade now. And so with that, I'm going to go ahead and pass it off to Joe to start the conversation, and we'll sit on the sidelines in case there are any technical questions that come up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here today. As Mark discussed, the Council of Economic Advisors mostly looks over the shoulder of the state economist and offers thoughts and criticism on the state economic forecast. In ordinary times, that's a fairly mundane task. We find things to disagree about then. But clearly, in light of the recession that we're in now and the effects of both the pandemic and more recently the wildfires, Oregon finds itself and Oregon's economy finds itself in a very different situation than we are in usually. And we've spent some time talking as a council, chatting with the governor about what we think some of the parameters are for thinking about what's going on in the economy right now and what things we can do to both ameliorate the negative effects of the recession we're experiencing as a result of the pandemic, and then also build a stronger economy going forward. And with that as sort of a general task, I'll sketch out some of what we think is going on with the economy and provide some context that I hope will be useful to the legislature as it thinks about policies going forward. And as Mark hinted at, I would hasten to add, while I try to channel what I would regard as the consensus of the council, there is really a diversity of opinions on there. And many of my colleagues would not necessarily agree with individual points here, and they'd offer additional commentary. So if you'll take it with the appropriate grain of salt, I'll proceed. And what I'd like to do is just throw up a few slides that I think encapsulate some of the key facts about the situation that we find ourselves in right now. And bear with me while I try and make the technology work here. We got it to work in rehearsal. And I think, sorry, if you'll bear with me. Are you seeing my screen now? Should be a title slide. That's an affirmative.
I see City Observatory on the screen.
Thank you. And by the way, City Observatory, my day job is working for City Observatory, which is an urban policy think tank. In a prior life, I spent a dozen years working for the state legislature as staff to the Trade and Economic Development Committee, but that's kind of ancient history now. And just a couple of things. First of all, I want to speak to the kind of forecast that you got from the state economist, and I think it was fundamentally right. In the early days of the recession, we predicted something we called a square root recession. That's really what we've seen, a very sharp fall off, and then a sharp bounce, and then and a more attenuated and uncertain recovery after that bounce. And the reason we say square root is that looks roughly like the radical sign that you would use to illustrate a square root. So, you know, a very abrupt shock and a very different kind of shock than we've experienced in the past. The other thing I'd just elaborate on is it looks like that square root could possibly be turning into a W. And these are some what we call high frequency data on employment in Oregon. This isn't the official employment department figures. These are data drawn from private payroll services. And you can see the same pattern that we charted earlier. And you see a couple of wobbles in the end of that diagram. And one of those wobbles, Chair Nathanson, corresponds, that first one, to the forest fires, the wildfires in early September. And we saw a fall off in employment there. And more recently, you know, despite the very positive employment report we got earlier this week at this aggregate statewide level, there seems to be a little bit of softness in these employment statistics as well. The positive thing here, I think, and I'll elaborate on this, is the stimulus package that was adopted at the federal level in the spring made a huge difference and triggered that rapid bounce back that we saw. But unfortunately, the positive effects of that seem to be running out. Obviously, there are things happening currently in Washington, D.C. that could extend that package into the new year. That's likely to be important to the trajectory of the national and to the Oregon economy going forward. The other thing that we should pay particular attention to is the differential impact of the recession on different groups of Oregon wage earners. And there are a lot of folks who are talking about this as what we call a K-shaped recession. And the reason we call it K-shaped is that the recovery part of it is very different depending on whether you're a high-wage worker or a low-wage worker. And these are data for Oregon that break Oregon workers up into three groups. The top 25% of all earners, people earning $60,000 or more, middle-wage workers, basically everybody in the middle, and low-wage workers, people in industries where they're earning less than $30,000 a year, roughly. And you can see that there's been a substantial rebound for high and middle-wage workers as the economy has progressed over the course of the year. But you can see that there's still a dramatic decline in employment for low-wage workers. And as I think about policy responses here, I think I worry particularly about the folks at the bottom end of the spectrum, because we know they are the hardest hit. We know they are the most vulnerable. We know they are the most dependent on the kinds of income supports and social services that the state is charged with administering. So I think a first key policy lesson here is to keep in mind that, you know, this is a recession that is being borne most heavily by the lowest wage workers in Oregon. The other thing that's really important to understand about this recession is it's very different in many respects from previous recessions. And it's been triggered largely not by kind of a collapse in financial markets, they're actually doing relatively well, nor is it caused by, you know, sort of a decline in investment. It's been triggered by a drop in consumer spending. We suddenly all stopped spending a lot of money in the early spring, and that's rebounded very slowly. But what triggered the decline in the economy was everybody essentially holding on to their money and not spending it. And as a result, that pushed us into recession. And the very, very positive note, as I said earlier, is that we threw a lot of money, the federal government did, trillions of dollars into the economy, and that kept things from being worse and triggered the recovery. But it's that decline in spending that's really the critical thing to pay attention to. And it's a kind of spending that has basically affected some sectors a lot more than others. So it's fallen on sectors where basically there is face-to-face interaction. And the clearest example of that is, for example, when you look at the restaurant and accommodation businesses. They're the ones who've seen the biggest declines in sales across the board of anybody. And those have largely persisted even to today. So it's specific consumer spending patterns have a lot to do with what's going on here. And that's kind of bad news and good news. The bad news is, you know, obviously we're still mired in the throes of the pandemic. The good news is consumers have money. They have saved a lot of money, especially higher income households. And when they feel comfortable to start spending it again, they have the money in hand. So what that means is when we do get on a clear path to recovery, there are good reasons to believe that it can move forward relatively rapidly. But again, this is a very different recession than we experienced in the Great Recession a decade ago. Nearly all of the decline in consumer spending was on durable goods in the Great Recession, and very little of it, in fact, none of it was in a reduction in services. This time it was a reduction in service spending. So a very different character with very different effects. And the job losses as a result have been in particularly in leisure and hospitality and the restaurant businesses and the like. The other thing I would say here is, you know, and this is something that I think economists have generally stressed for the last several months, is at this point, the COVID cycle is the business cycle. And I think we're seeing that right now. The reason the economy is weak now has everything to do with consumers having increasing trepidation as a result of the surge in COVID cases. And the reason I throw this chart up is what it shows basically the variation in consumer spending in states that reopened. That's the green state, or the orange states, the yellowish states on this chart, and a similar group of states that didn't reopen. And you can see that consumer spending patterns followed the same trajectory, which tells you that, you know, not only do businesses respond to, obviously, to closures and to openings, but that consumers look at the risk of the disease, not just whether there's openings and closings. So in a very important sense, the economic effects of the coronavirus are due to the decisions that we make as consumers as much or as more of the policies that states are putting in place. And the upshot of that is we won't get over this this crisis until we lick the virus. And it isn't simply a matter of getting the reopening requirements or the closure requirements to go away. You have to make the disease go away. There's one other point that I'll throw up here on the diagram and then cut away from these slides, which is we know that Oregonians face a big cliff. A lot of Oregonians who have gotten extended benefits. These are some statistics that we got courtesy of Mark McMullen and his colleagues, and basically shows the number of people who run out of unemployment insurance. It's about 128,000 people, absent an extension of the current set of programs that we face, that could run out of their benefits. That would have a substantial negative effect on our economy if that were to happen. So that's something I think to pay, again, particular attention to as we think about the impacts of this recession and what we do about it. So, And
Joe, since you are transitioning away from the slides explaining the situation to us, I need to ask you, to comply with our rules, will you please state your name for the record? I apologize. I should have asked you at the beginning.
Sorry, that's an egregious sin for a former committee administrator. For the record, Joe Courtwright, I'm an economist in Portland, Oregon.
Thank you.
And so I would just touch on one other thing, because I think it came up here, and that's the wildfire. And as I see the wildfires, the effect of the wildfires in consumer expenditures and in that high frequency employment data in September. And the way I would characterize the wildfires is there's a big short term negative in September. As you discussed in your property tax discussion just before this item, there's a significant loss to the people and communities who are affected by those fires. That's a big loss. That said, as we go forward, the historic record for forest fires and other natural disasters is the stimulus spending going forward. Money that flows in from the federal government, money that we have to spend as state governments, will have a stimulative effect on the economy. So in terms of the long run effects, there'll be some gain from that. Now, I appreciate that's not something anybody would wish for, it's a mission in light of all that we've experienced. But as we look at the Oregon economy over the next several years, there will be some stimulus from that event to drive things forward. I think the challenge, just to summarize, is to deal with the negative effects that we're still in with the pandemic, and to help in particular those very hard hit workers at the lower end of the labor market who are most vulnerable and who face the toughest situation, particularly as unemployment insurance benefits expire. And then also, how do you build and how you transition to a robust economy? And I think there will be the opportunity to take advantage of growth coming out of this, because a lot of consumers, particularly well-off households, better-off households, have been accumulating savings. And as they start spending them, that will help drive economic opportunity going forward.
Thank you. Representative Reschke has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Joe, thank you for your presentation. I don't see it on OLIS, though, so I'm wondering if we can get a copy of the presentation. If it's not on OLIS right now, or if it could be emailed to us, that'd be great.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I was a little bit dilatory. I've emailed that to Chris, and he should have it for you as a PDF.
Very good. Thank you.
Madam Chair, go ahead. Yes, Representative Smith, and then after you, we'll go back to Joe.
Thank you. And Joe, thank you for your presentation. It's always good to hear your wisdom, and it's appreciated. I especially appreciated your comment on the curve looking like a K, if you will, because I definitely know for a fact through the profession I have that there are definite winners that are coming out or being created through this economic crisis / pandemic, and there's definite losers. The best example I have of a winner is a liquor store. A liquor store has been able to access PPP dollars, which was intended to keep their business open, to keep their employees intact. Well, they never had intentions of closing. And so not only have their revenue increased, but they also receive stimulus dollars, significant stimulus dollars that otherwise, but for the events before us, would never have had. And I could go down the list, drugstores. We all know those companies that are open and never had to close, but did access those dollars. And so I think as a revenue committee, we need to be sensitive to that fact, that there have been extraordinarily significant winners and people who are devastated. This morning I got off the phone with a very prominent citizen in my district whose business has been shut down, simply can't open up, and had zero debt. a business that had zero debt 9 months ago now have $75,000 worth of debt. Now, the one thing I do want to ask, not necessarily take exception because I don't think I would ever challenge your wisdom, Joe, but you shared the fact that many consumers are reluctant to participate in the economy at this time, and I don't disagree with you. On the other hand, and this is the part where I just want to get this noted, there are many consumers who are ready to participate but can't because the businesses are closed down. And so as we look at those economic forces, I strongly agree with your statement, but I think there needs to be an added statement that we do have citizens who can't shop simply because those alternatives aren't available to them. Thank you, Madam Chair, and appreciate your leadership.
Yeah, and Representative Nathanson, Representative Smith, I think you're exactly right that different businesses have experienced this recession very differently. We know that, for example, you know, all that money we didn't spend going out to restaurants, we're now spending at grocery stores. And roughly speaking, grocery store sales are up about 20% year over year.
Thank you. Joe?
And you're also right. Yes.
I think we have, and for the committee, I think we have about 17 or 18 minutes more left. I want to make sure that you're able to share with us all the rest of the thoughts that you had prepared for us, and then we'll take additional questions, and Representative Owens will be first in that list.
Okay. I think I have said most of what I wanted to get out, and I want to be responsive to the committee's questions as much as possible. So please, let's go on to questions. Chair
okay.
Nathanson.
Representative Owens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Joe, for your presentation. And I was also able to watch your last Economic Advisory Council committee meeting with the governor. I appreciated that opportunity that the governor gave us and that you guys gave us, so thank you. My question might take us down a rabbit hole, Joe, and Madam Chair, if it's better served later, let me know. But as I look at your bar graphs and I look at our last several revenue forecasts, our ending fund balance has been a yo-yo. And I feel that the last revenue forecast was based on a lot of potential hypotheticals of more federal stimulus, COVID numbers maybe staying the same or declining, and those are not guarantees. As you said, the economic fortunes of some of our groups are following the virus curve, and even with the vaccine out, I see these elevated cases staying for a period of time. With all that said, we know our ending fund balance currently is approximately $1 billion. And we're going to be asked on Monday to spend down a considerable amount of that ending fund balance, $800 million. As an economist, is that a wise choice at this time? Could we potentially be putting us in a position in 3 to 4 months to have to go into our emergency funds if some of the hypotheticals don't come through?
Yeah, that's a terrific question, and a lot of it depends on your judgments and your risk aversion as legislators. And you're right to say that two of the particular kinds of expertise required in this forecast now are epidemiology and forecasting what Congress will do, which economists don't have any special insight into. That said, I'd point out a couple of things. First of all, the downside of that K-shaped recovery or K-shaped recession is it's dramatically affected lower wage Oregonians the most. The good news is our revenues have held up better than we expected because there's been a less of a decline for higher income households. So I think, and I also think the worst of this recession event is likely behind us. So I don't want to say there's a definite economic answer to how much of your ending balance you want to put into relieving the pain of this transition, which will proceed over most of next year. But I do think that there's a plausible case to be made that both buffering the negative effects on people who are hard hit and then giving them some resources that they can then spend that then help stimulate the economy is probably a prudent course going forward. You set aside rainy day funds for rainy days, and it's raining.
Thank you.
Joe, I'm going to take the next opportunity to pose a question to you. Given that this committee deals largely with tax policy or the administration of the tax code, for example, we heard earlier about many different actions that the Department of Revenue did to try to help taxpayers, you know, whether it's regarding when taxes are owed or penalties that are accruing and so forth. Given that we deal largely with either tax policy or the process of administering the tax code, are there any actions that you or maybe you've heard other members of the group, your group, the advisors talk about that relate to these three topic areas, which I believe are a big concern? One is childcare. Businesses have employees who are struggling to return to work or maybe can't return to work because of a need for childcare because schools aren't open. So there's a big issue with childcare. Another is, what about workers that may permanently opt to leave the workforce? What are we thinking may happen 6 months or a year from now for the state's, the underpinnings of our economy if some of the workers don't return to the workforce at all? Because they've just altered their view on what they need for their family income or how they approach work. Maybe they're thinking of becoming independent entrepreneurs, for example. And then also the potential disruptions in housing, whether it's from rents or mortgages. Are there any thoughts about any one or two of those areas that people on your group have been talking about?
Yeah, and I think we've, Chair Nathanson, we've kicked around pieces of that. So I'll give you my best reaction to it. First, on childcare, it kind of goes without saying that because this is primarily affected service industries, it's disproportionately affected women, and women have more of a childcare burden in most households. And as a result, childcare turns out to be, you know, I think a really critical component in the recovery and helping people be able to re-enter the labor force and for us to get going again. I don't know if I have any, you know, clever policy initiatives there. Second one, permanent leavers from the workforce. I think, you know, the evidence is that's what recessions do. Recessions are periods of time when if people are on the verge of leaving the labor force, they tend to do so and don't come back. But that's, I'm not sure that makes a permanent change. It just may accelerate somewhat at the rate at which some older workers in particular leave the labor force. The really encouraging news from before the whole pandemic is after running the economy flat out for, you know, 5 years and lowering the unemployment rate, you know, to below 4%, we made significant progress in reducing the income gaps between non-Hispanic whites and people of color in the state of Oregon. Much more progress than we'd made in the preceding couple of decades. So once the economy rebounds and if we fuel growth, I think that will actually create a lot of opportunities because that's what it was doing before the pandemic. And then your final point on housing, yeah, I think we can expect to see some repricing, particularly in commercial real estate markets. You know, the fact that there's so much, you know, essentially restaurant space going vacant right now, that will continue to be the case for some time. But strangely, we've had a lot of strength in the housing market because people, frankly, can't spend money on consumer services. And interest rates have dropped. So, you know, we've seen a real surge in housing, and it's been a product, I think, of again, the peculiar nature of this recession, because in every previous recession, it's sort of housing has let us down. This is the opposite of that.
Committee, are there any other questions from you or comments you'd like to make on what we've heard? Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just, again, I want to say, Joe, thanks for the presentation. It was good. The K-shaped recovery or the recession, whatever it's called, is rather troubling. I think that the income disparity between those that have and have not, I don't see a single, at least in my lifetime, that there's been a wider gap than we're going to see here because of this. So it's we need to take care as far as what we decide going forward and make sure that we help those that have. Well, somebody once said that, you know, on a chicken and egg, on a ham and egg breakfast, the chicken sacrifices and the ham, I mean, the chicken contributes and the ham sacrifices. And to think that everybody is sacrificed equally in this during this time is just not true. I mean, your graph clearly shows that. So while some have made concessions and been inconvenienced, others are losing their homes or about to, or losing their businesses and about to. So again, I just wanted to make a comment that's rather troubling to me, and we'll be looking for opportunities to try to fix that.
Thanks.
Thank you. Anyone else on the committee? Chris, we've had several conversations about what we've done already this year, either the legislature or state agencies, what is being, is something that's being worked on. That was from Representative Marsh, and now this, food for thought going forward. Are there any final points you want to make for us?
I don't think so. I think it's been a, I guess what I'd say, it's been a good discussion, and hopefully the members of the committee will be able to take this information and put some thought into it, and as everybody prepares for the next session, so as we roll into the next session, the legislature is poised to respond as best we can.
Thank you. Mr. Courtright, Mr. McMullen, thank you very much for being with us this afternoon.
Thank you.
And everyone else who presented earlier, Department of Revenue and Legislative Revenue Office, thank you, everybody. Chris, I think we've completed our work for the day. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay.
For today.
We're adjourned.